I feel like the ultimate mixed up kid in a way. I was born in Sri Lanka, but a civil war rather inconveniently happened on our doorstep, and we were chased out one dark night when I was a child, and ended up as nomads wandering around the world, really. But there are lots of Sri Lankan refugees around, so that's nothing particularly unusual. And we ended up spread all over the world. I was educated in UK, but ended up in Hong Kong. Went there on honeymoon and loved the place and stayed ever since. So technically, this is the 20th year of my honeymoon. You know, all our wedding presents are still back at the place we got married, still unopened. We haven't even opened the boxes yet. So it's like a scene from a Dickens novel, really, or something. So I've been in Hong Kong ever since, and I've sort of become Chinese, I reckon. You know, my favourite foods are now Chinese foods, and my kids are all Chinese, they're all adopted Chinese children. And it was interesting, at the hotel in Sydney I was staying at yesterday, I was called upon to translate between a group of Chinese residents and the hotel staff. And I could see the staff couldn't help giggling that this Indian-looking gentleman was translating for the, you know, Chinese for the hotel.
How did the love affair really kick off?
Hong Kong's not really a city as such. It's a sort of grand central station of people moving around the world. I mean, if you think about the numbers, there are, you know, between 6 and 7 million people technically live there, but many, many times more than that, somewhere between 12 and 20 million people actually are tourists. They're moving in and out in any given year. So in more ways than any other city, it's really a depot. And I think the fact that people are moving in and out all the time gives it a different atmosphere to most cities. I mean, even the 6 or 7 million people who are residents are not resident in the way that, say, Sydneysiders are resident of Sydney, or Melbourne people are residents of Melbourne. In that, until about 1970-something, more than half the population of Hong Kong were expats. They were born somewhere else and went to Hong Kong to work or as refugees. And even today, the bulk of the population, their parents, are from outside Hong Kong. So it's a whole city of people who don't belong there, who have just gone there to work. A whole city of expatriates, if you like, which is one of the things I think that gives it the energy and buzz it has, because everyone's just come there and they may move somewhere else next. It's a city on the move.
What I found was, it really is the type of city, it's great for the voyeur, someone who wants to watch people. It's a big window onto the street. The coffee shops still aren't up to scratch, but you can still sit in a coffee shop and see some great stuff happening. Do you find that it really is just wondering and wondering about how everything works is what drives Hong Kong?
Yes, that's right. And a lot of new things are developed there that you don't really see anywhere else, and spread to other places. One of the things I celebrate in my books is the new language. There's a new language evolved in Asia Pacific, which is basically a sort of clipped down English. You hear it in Hong Kong, Singapore, Shanghai, Beijing, Kuala Lumpur, and it's sort of practical English, just the verbs, just the key nouns. So you know, instead of I'd like to go to the restroom, you know, they just say toilet, you know. Instead of where's the money you owe me, they say where got, and they stick out their hand. You know, it's a very short, sweet, clipped English, and I try and capture that in my books. It's a very useful language. You can learn it in a week, and you can communicate with it in almost anywhere around the planet. So Asian English is a fabulous thing that's developed in Hong Kong.
Before the Feng Shui Detective novels and your children's books, you were rocking the boat with South China Morning Post.
I mean, looking back on that period now, it's a funny time, but it was fairly stressful at the time. You know, the handover of Hong Kong from British rule to Chinese rule happened in 1997. But the real handover, the mental handover, happened a few years before. It was between about 1994 to 1997. That was the period when everybody was desperately trying to second guess what would happen in Hong Kong after the handover. And so columnists and cartoonists were being sacked by the dozen. You know, anybody who put a foot wrong was summarily ejected. And it was a very dramatic time. For me, I had a reputation as sort of the most daring columnist. So my readers were always goading me on to go to further and further lengths. Like, I remember the day Deng Xiaoping died, and I got all these messages from readers saying, go on then, make a joke about that. See if you dare. So I racked my brain. You know, he just died at the age of 92. So I did put in a joke about that. So I wrote, the great man Deng Xiaoping is dead. Let that be a lesson to all of us. Smoking kills. And, you know, it wasn't the funniest joke in the world, but, you know, it was a joke about Deng Xiaoping, the Chinese leader. And at that time, of course, it caused a sensation because, like, nobody would dare to say anything about the Chinese leaders, let alone joke about the death of the greatest of the Chinese leaders. So that kind of made my reputation. And it eventually, of course, got me sacked from the South China Morning Post. But it didn't upset me very much because I just knew it was going to happen. And I was surprised indeed that I'd survived so long. I can remember a conference in Indonesia where the information minister called all the columnists and cartoonists together and said, please do not make jokes about politicians. You may disappear. Joking can be fatal. And I had to write that down. Joking can be fatal. I thought that's so true of Asian journalism.
Your latest book, The Shanghai Union of Industrial Mystics. You have now moved C.F. Wong and Winnie Lin and Joyce McQuinney to Shanghai after spending time in Singapore and Hong Kong over the last couple of books. What was it like going to Shanghai this time and going to the mainland and, I suppose, the motherland for much of this and doing your research?
Well, you know, I'm delighted that to provide a service in a way, because people still think of China as this big rural place where people wear conical hats and stand with their knees in the paddy fields. And in fact, that image is accurate. You know, there are still 700 million peasants who do wear conical hats and stand in the paddy fields. But there's also the other side of urban China, which is terribly capitalistic and modern and futuristic even. So I wanted to show Shanghai as the modern China, full of cappuccino shops and Western things. You know, I think one of the great joys of China is that it is still ostensibly communist. So you turn on the TV and you get these politicians making these speeches about the glorious march of communism around the world and how every day that passes it becomes increasingly obvious that communism is the only system that works and the entire world is celebrating communism and waiting for the moment when everybody is communist. You know, you see these speeches all the time in China and they're hilarious because they're so obviously untrue. Everyone knows they're untrue. And at the same time, in China itself, things are amazingly capitalistic. You can buy or sell anything in China. I remember going to going around the tourist sites, and I had my adopted Chinese baby under one arm. And I went to one site, and a woman from the shopping stalls noticed that I'd bought a souvenir of Beijing hat. And she pointed to my hat, and she said, "How much you pay for that? It's cheaper here." And then she saw my souvenir sports bag with Great Wall on the side. And she said, "How much you pay for that?" And then she noticed that the baby under my arm was Chinese. And she pointed to the baby and say, "How much you pay for that?" You know, so maybe think, wow, you can buy anything in China, can't you? No. She was going to offer me a cheaper baby.
How has it been taken on board with people who have been following the Feng Shui Detective series, now seeing it arrive in China?
Well, you know, China's a bit of a hot happening place. Tourists are pouring into China, so it is a happening place. And places all over the world, including Australia, people are taking Chinese lessons. And they realise that China's going to be a major part of the world economy and also a part of the world's culture very soon, in the way that America has dominated earlier. You know, Chinese culture will play a role. So I think people have reacted well to the book as a source of learning about modern China, as well as, you know, just a story set in China. You know, I can't think of another book. There probably is one, but I can't think of another book which actually captures in a fun, fictional way, you know, a feeling of what life in a modern Chinese urban city is like, you know, from the point of view of a visitor and a Chinese person. My two main characters, one's a Chinese mainlander, and the other is an Australian girl who's working as the mainlander's assistant.
I hate to ask this question, but how much of C.F. Wong is in Nuri Vitachi?
You know, I started off trying to make these guys archetypes. You know, they started off as genuine stereotypes. So I've got two characters. C.F. Wong is male, he's old, he's sexist, he's racist, he's taciturn, he's the ultimate Asian. The other character, Joyce McQuinney, is the ultimate opposite. She's young, she's female, she's, you know, vegetarian, she's right on, she's anti-sexist, anti-racist. We've got these two archetypal extremes who clash against each other. My job as a writer was to make them realistic and funny. But I never realised who C.F. Wong was based on until someone made an animated cartoon, film short based on one of my books. And C.F. Wong appeared as small and fat and wearing Western clothes. And I said, no. He's skinny, he's bald, and he wears Asian clothes all the time. He's militantly Asian. And then I realised that I described myself, you know, down to a T. So that's when I realised that C.F. Wong was actually me. One of the reasons why I chose Feng Shui as a theme is that it is uniquely Asian, yet at the same time it's something that anybody can relate to, and people from all different cultures are sort of fascinated by it. You know, I'm always spoiling people's offices because you know, I come in and say, oh, you can't have that there, and you know, they have to move everything around. But it's something that most people can relate to. They realize that your environment does affect your mood and the way you work and your, you know, level of success even. So it's something that everyone can relate to, but yet it's, you know, it's uniquely Asian. I think there's Chinese feng shui, Indian feng shui, but it has this lovely Asian feel that I think is a, you know, I feel the West has given so much to Asia, and I include Australia in that. The West dominates entertainment, it dominates music, it dominates cinema, and there are a few things that Asians are good at that we can give back to world culture. One is the spiritual things like feng shui, like meditation. The other, of course, is food. I mean, Asian food, you can't beat Asian food.
C.F. Wong, a lot of the time throughout the books, there's a lot of his verse and a lot of his musings on mysticism. And he's actually working in the current book on his literary masterpiece called Some Gleanings of Oriental Wisdom. With a lot of your stuff outside of writing, are you actually practicing as a feng shui master sometimes? Or actually bringing all of that in?
Yes, there's this lovely dichotomy in Asian culture whereby we're terribly spiritual, you know. We all have our Zen anecdotes. We all believe in feng shui or vastu, which is the Indian equivalent. We all talk about spiritual things all the time. And yet, while this is going on, we're terribly money grubbing. I mean, Asians are very focused on money and achievement. So I like this clash. So my main character is working on this book of Oriental wisdom, all of which is very anti-materialistic. And at the same time, he is the most materialistic person on earth. I just thought that was realistic, and most Asians tend to be like that. So the books are sprinkled with anecdotes and stories from the book that the character is writing. In a way, that's backfired on me. I get several letters from readers saying, I don't like your writing, and I don't think your detective stories are very good. However, I do like the writings of Mr. C.F. Wong. Where can I buy some more? Readers are weird creatures. They often think that things you make up are real. And in fact, to be honest, quite a few of the C.F. Wong writings are genuine writings from ancient Chinese documents. You know, I've just copied them. But several of my publishers have actually said, why don't you do a book of C.F. Wong writings, you know, and we'll publish it under the name C.F. Wong, you know. So I'm quite tempted by this, but it worries me at the same time because, you know, I know that if that outsells Shanghai Union of Industrial Mystics, then, you know, the publishers will drop me and they'll just be C.F. Wong's publisher instead. You know, it'll be a case of the creation eating the creator.